Hi, my name is Chip Spear, and you're listening to Earth Plus 30. Welcome. Today, I finish up my conversation with Keith Marin. In parts one and two, we laid out the problems that exist in today's world and one of the reasons that we are confronted with what many perceive to be a lack of impactful, positive leadership in our world. Keith and I go into a discussion now about how to resolve many of the problems that we laid out in parts one and two. So I welcome you to join me in listening to Keith and I in our conversation for part three.
Keith, I've been very excited to do this part three with the first two parts. I kind of finished those two recordings and was, wow, this was fascinating talking about where we were, how we kind of got where we are in our kind of human evolution and talking about society and leadership. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited to sort of take the next step. And I remember we were talking about paradigms and the nature of leadership, what we need to do, and how leaders today don't really think in terms of that broad scope, the long term, the need for systematic changes, and also, and this is the thing that really stuck in my mind, self-awareness. Mm-hmm. You know, and the other thing that really struck me was when you personally started looking at yourself holistically and saying, I am going to live until I'm 110 or 115, I forget the exact date, but you started to think about what you do every day very differently. And that made a big impression on me because if we just extrapolate that out and take it from the micro to the macro, it really changes how we deal with our entire world, right?
Yeah. Well, that was just an example of when you look long term, it changes your way of seeing.
Right. So let's start talking about that, because to me, that's pretty impactful and it leads to, going to that solution, how we're going to solve these various problems. And as you say, how we're going to change our leaders to think more that way.
Yeah. Well, I'm not even sure we're going to change our leaders to think that way, but I'll explain that in a little bit. What I'm hoping is that alternative leaders show up whose level of consciousness or way of understanding helps bring us forward. That's more likely that will cause a change than the current leaders changing their own paradigms.
Yeah, it's like the new generation, right? Whatever that generate, however you want to define that new generation, but another generation of leaders will come into power or take over or something of that nature, yeah. Right?
Well, that's not quite what I was meaning. That may be true. Let me step back and talk about different stages of development or different levels of consciousness, because it is central to the whole thesis of what kind of leadership is going to make a difference. And it ties directly to, I think Einstein's famous quote, you can't solve today's problems with the same level of consciousness that created them, is really apt to understanding what I meant when I said other leaders. It wasn't necessarily a new generation. It could be the current generation, but leaders with a different consciousness. So it starts with the notion, or we start with the notion, that people are at different stages of development. This comes from Piaget's work, which I think we talked about earlier. Is that correct?
Yes, we did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did. Okay. So the let's define simply three or four different stages of development, of adult development or consciousness. One stage of development you might call very concrete black and white thinking. And at that stage of development, the person tends to have very crude emotional relationship to one's own emotions, and one's cognitive development is rather simple and basic. And let's just call that the conventional wisdom or conventional thinking or conventional stage of consciousness. The next stage we might call problem-solving consciousness, where the person is able to solve problems and analyze those problems. The next stage we might call mutuality, where the person is able to see things from other people's vantage points, is able to understand themselves much more intimately, has much greater self-awareness, is able to see their own subjectivity, and therefore, when they get into a disagreement with somebody else, they don't just try to shove their own view on the other, they try to take the point of view of the other. And let's call that stage three, or the next stage, and then stage four would be systemic consciousness, able to look at the totality of the problem, able to look at a whole system, able to look further down the road, and a high degree of self-awareness, high degree of recognition that one's own awareness or perception shapes how they see, which then shapes the way in which they solve problems. So these are four different stages, and you can track just about anybody in the world. You can listen to them and understand them and see, and discover at what stage of development they live. And the point that I was making, and we can go much more in depth about what I just said, but that if you understand that people naturally go through stages of development, but they plateau at a certain stage and often don't grow beyond that stage, they have the potential of growing beyond the stage. There's a natural ordering of those stages that I described, but they plateau at a certain stage. I would say that the modal level of consciousness of the leaders of most of the countries of our planet is somewhere around stage two. That is, that they are promulgating a view of the world based on problem-solving abilities, but they're not looking at the world systemically, and they can't because they don't think that way. Their level of consciousness won't allow it. And so what I was saying when I said new leaders, I meant leaders that have a stage four consciousness, who naturally look at the world in a spatial way, in a systemic way, who are able to recognize their own subjectivity. Those leaders are much more likely to solve the problems that were created by the leaders from stage two consciousness.
So I think about two aspects of that. One is either developing or finding those new leaders. And then getting them in a position where they're actually able to make impactful changes, meaning like become president of the United States. How do you get them through a democratic process, you know, the campaigning and all that stuff, to that position of power so that they can actually achieve the things that are necessary and use those capabilities?
That would be one of the key questions. Part of the problem is that most people in society are at stage one or two. That's the modal level of consciousness in our country. And it's that consciousness that voted for Trump. And so Trump is a reflection of the consciousness of the people who voted for him.
Right.
And so Trump is not able to do anything more than what he does. He does not step into the shoes of other people. If he does, he steps into their shoes in order to understand and figure out how to manipulate them better. You know, he wrote the book, The Art of the Deal, and his goal is to try to control and manipulate. So he is able to understand others only as far as his own paradigm can go, and then he manipulates and controls. So he is portraying and depicting a level of consciousness that our voters voted.
I understand. Yeah. I mean, just look at this weekend, that Tulsa thing. Slow down the testing. Slow down the testing. You know, it's like an ostrich putting their head in the sand. It doesn't exist if he can't see it. Close your eyes. Close your eyes. I can't see that that's, a crash or there's a train coming at me. Then it doesn't exist. It's not going to happen. Yeah. I mean, you could extrapolate it out to almost anything. It's just, it was like one of, saddest, funniest, I don't know, black or something. What? Okay.
Exactly. So this he's intelligent enough in the sense that he has some cognitive abilities, but his tendency to control and manipulate is to me legendary and causes confusion. Let's not spend too much time on Trump because he's not alone. There are a lot of leaders who in positions of power whose goal is to try to stay in a position of power and keep the prevailing paradigm as it is. In other words, they enjoy the benefits of the of our current paradigm on this planet. Mm-hmm. And so they're motivated to keep themselves. The question is, how do you replace them? And the answer is slowly and little by little, little by little over time, as we hopefully shift the consciousness on the planet.
So I want to talk about your strategy here, both, what you're personally doing and how you want to expand this so that it is, it extends beyond your immediate personal reach.
Yeah. So my strategy I'll give the simple version, but I'll, as you and others who are listening can probably tell, there's no simple answer to anything. These are complex problems that require multivalent understanding, and I'm not even sure I understand all the variables myself, but I'm certainly looking at it through a multivariate lens. So, The simple answer is work with people in positions of power in companies that will hopefully in the future be some of the leading companies. And so my thought is if I can catch companies that are young and people that are young and work with them over time, I'll help them develop their consciousness and help their company become more at the forefront or leadership of their industry. And the more that happens, the more prominent they become. And the more that happens, the more likely they are able to influence the planet. So I see the leaders of the organizations that I work with as my fulcrum points to try to affect change. I don't work with political leaders much at all. I'd be happy to, but there aren't many political leaders that have an appetite for looking at their own paradigms. They are simply wanting to affect the world, but they're not as self-aware as I would like. So I'd be happy to work with ones that are.
Do you think that that's only because they really aren't that aware, or is it because of the system in which they exist? So they're forced to think that way so much of the time that unless you really sit down and start to peel away some of the layers beneath the surface, will they say, oh yeah, well, I do think this way, but I can't really think about that enough because I'm so busy trying to raise tons of money for my reelection that I don't think systemically.
Probably to some extent that's true. I think that's an intelligent thought, Chip. I think that, oh my goodness, the game that you have to play to get elected is a game that works against your ability to truly speak your mind, truly advocate for something that's outside the prevailing paradigm. So the people with money currently are mostly happy to enjoy the prevailing paradigm or the prevailing conditions, and they're the ones that will want to elect new people in power. So it's almost as if the game is stacked hugely against you if you're a leader who's at a stage for consciousness. I think that's right. But there are a few that peek through. Rand Paul is certainly somebody who's tried to break out of the prevailing paradigm. Bernie Sanders, to some extent, does, and to some extent doesn't. And there are others that pop through here and there.
Like, what about how would you perceive, or how do you perceive AOC, for example?
What's AOC?
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Oh, you can tell I'm not terribly political. I really don't know her well enough, but mm-hmm. she's certainly shaken things up a bit. And yeah. and those kinds of leaders, you can see they do shake things up a bit. They do come forward and challenge the prevailing myth, but that they then don't get into the position of power that I might want them to get in. But
right.
yeah, you know, little by little, there's a growing mass of people that will reach critical mass at some point, hopefully in our lifetime, maybe mm-hmm. not, maybe in our children's lifetime, that when that critical mass shows, that will shift the consciousness. And in fact, many change efforts in organizations and in society happen not when 60% of the population shifts their thinking, but when 15 or 20% shift their thinking, but they're a vocal mass and a relatively organized mass of people that can hugely accelerate change on the planet. So we're not at critical mass yet of AOC and others, but we are little by little getting there. And my, you know, the simple answer to what I'm doing is trying to nudge that forward one leader at a time.
Let's pretend that I'm running a company and I engage you, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a medium-sized company. Let's say mm-hmm. We'll just say 500 employees or something like that.
Yeah.
Talk to me about how you approach your job. You know what? Yeah. How do you break that down? Because I'm a listener, listening to this podcast and say, okay, so our leaders have to get to this stage four systematic analysis. What exactly, how do I get there? How does my boss get there? How do I get there? What exactly does that, what steps do I take? What do I have to read or learn or be aware of? Or who do I have to talk to or listen to or watch or all that stuff? So.
Well, are you a CEO of the whole organization or are you a leader within?
Well, let's look at CEO first and then maybe sure. somebody within.
Yeah. So if you're a CEO who's already interested in working with me, and I've already stated the nature of the work that I do, which is to help organizations become extraordinary, to help them become industry leaders and sustain that leadership over time. And I do that by working with the leaders, as well as helping those leaders develop a healthy culture. So you know that about me. You've heard about me from some other client that I work with or a friend of yours who's worked with me. And you decide, you'd like to explore this. One of my first questions is going to be, what are you wanting to create or what are you wanting to accomplish in your organization? What are your aspirations? And let's say they are, to make a big dent in the industry. I would... And typically the leader will likely say something about, my culture, it's pretty good, or my strategy is okay, we're not quite aligned, I think we have some problems we need to fix, I think we've got to, I think there's a few people that are on board on my team that aren't really that great, I need to change them out, I have some thoughts about improving the organization. So they talk with me and I ask questions and I get an understanding of what they're seeing about the organization. At some point along the way, I'm going to say something like the following to you, the CEO. Jack or Susie, this organizational problems that you're describing, I have a particular point of view that says the quality of the organization is a reflection of the consciousness of the leadership. And so while you're spending a lot of time so far telling me about what's not working or what needs to be fixed, I'd like to turn our attention on you as a leader and ask you, how is your leadership creating the very problems that you've just described? Because there's no doubt that the quality of your consciousness is going to create, your conduct and behavior, your conduct and character is going to meaningfully shape the organization and its culture. So let's talk about you. And so that's a meaningful moment in the discourse, because if that leader has no capacity to look inward and to notice that their behavior is meaningfully shaping the organization, then I don't want to work with that leader. Basically, my job is to hold up a mirror in front of the leader and say, when the leader keeps pointing to the problems outside of themselves, I want them to look in the mirror. And so they've got to be at a level of consciousness that at least has enough self-awareness and a high degree of appetite to grow and to change themselves. They can't change the organization if they can't change themselves, because the organization is a reflection of themselves. So I want them to get that, and it just becomes a huge, meaningful moment. And 9 times out of 10, the CEO just go, their eyes get big and they start to go, oh my goodness, this is the guy I want to work with, because I do want the organization to be better. And I want to grow. And this guy's not going to hold back, and he's going to keep the mirror right in front of me. So 9 times out of 10, it's a huge, valuable moment, and we end up falling in love. 1 out of 10, or every now and then, the leader goes, okay, bugger out. I'm not interested. You're not getting me. It's not me, it's them. And I go, got it. Find someone to help you fix the organization. I'm not your guy.
And the most of the time, these leaders get it?
Yeah. Most of the time they do. Even leaders that don't enter in with that thought, and many don't. They enter in with the thought, I just want to fix these problems and I want some help. But through the discourse, they're able to recognize, it's kind of like of course, that actually makes a heck of a lot of sense, Keith, and you're right, and let's look at me. Most leaders either start there or they get there if they're talking with me. And you have to remember, there's already a sifting process. Somebody looks at my website and they see all these words about transformation and consciousness, and they're going to already have seen that and decide whether or not they're even willing to talk with me. So by the time they get to me, they're already somewhat vetted by self-vetting process. Or they would be turned off by the stuff on my website and they would go, this is not the kind of consultant I want. I want somebody who's going to fix things. And so, yeah, 9 out of 10. But I'm not saying 9 out of 10 leaders have that view. I'm just saying 9 out of 10 leaders that get to me typically have that view. I would venture to guess that maybe a third to a half of CEOs have the view I just described.
Right.
And maybe, that many are at least stage 3. The modal level of consciousness on the planet is stage 1 or 2, but the modal level of consciousness of leadership of organizations is stage 2 or 3.
So what do you say? A guy says, okay, I'm open. So let's look at these. What do I need to do to start thinking about this? Or how can we be more successful? Because that's ultimately what I'm trying to get to, is like solution, in a way, strategically finding solutions so that we can put together that plan to get to that future, right? And what that means. And then it gets translated in some kind of tactical activity. You do, what I do, or what the CEO does, before we then tackle the leadership within an organization that's not the CEO, right?
Yeah. Well, so what I'm about to say may or may not be completely germane to the overall arc of our storyline, but the short answer is I typically start with some kind of assessment of the organization, and I would do an assessment of that leader in some way, either informally through interviews, or I might do a 360-degree feedback process where the leader takes a look at their own leadership abilities. And I've developed a 360 for this purpose. But do an organizational assessment. The first book that I wrote was called Riding the Wave, which is about looking at organizations and their social architecture. And so I'll do an analysis of the vision of the organization, the quality of the leadership, how well do the leaders work together, how clear is the strategy, is it a healthy, effective strategy, do people understand the strategy, are they committed to the strategy, are people aligned with it, how effective and healthy is the culture, and is the organization well-structured, and are all those things aligned with one another, strategy, mm-hmm. structure, culture, vision, all well-aligned. And that becomes my, in a sense, diagnosis of the organization. And then the 360 and the conversations I have would be my diagnosis of the leader. And then we start to talk about the organization, what's working, what's not working. We're looking at it much more deeply, not as a set of symptoms, but what are the mm-hmm. causes of those symptoms? And how is this person's leadership or the quality of the leadership team affecting that organizational system and structure and culture. So I do the assessment first. We then sit down, typically me and the CEO or me and the whole leadership team. We talk about the organization, we talk about leadership, and then we create a game plan over the next 2 to 5 years to help the organization shift and grow. Alternatively, sometimes I am dealing with very specific acute problems, such as there's a conflict between these two people and would you help them through it? Or we have this team that's not working well together or there are specific small symptoms of the organization that I might work with before we do this big grand organizational transformation effort. But either way, that's kind of how it goes, a diagnosis, feedback, and then a discussion of where to go. And then what I'm doing is coaching the CEO in developing, helping him or her transform and develop. I'm coaching the leadership, the other leaders and them as a team, helping them work together as a team, helping the other leaders get better and better. And I'm helping them learn how to shape the culture. And it's a learning process. I'm much more an educator than I am somebody who's going to go in and fix things. And so that's roughly how I work. I think one of the interesting questions we ought to get to is how do you help a leader transform? You know, what are the processes for doing that? But that, in essence, is how I work with a client.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. How do you do that? How do you get that person to transform, become a better person, be more aware, to be fully a part of that fourth stage?
Yeah. Well, I have to put in a shameless plug here for my new book that just came out a week ago, which is called The Art of Transformational Coaching. And basically, I've developed over the years this recipe, in effect, for how do you help somebody transform their paradigm. And I'm usually very overt about it, where we contract and agree that the goal of our work is to help the CEO or whoever I'm coaching, help them transform into a more powerful, more capable, more healthy version of themselves. We start with what wants to change, who in you or how in you want to change, what is the change that you're wanting, what is your aim? And I help them articulate that aim so they have a vision for where they want to go.
Do you find they're often aware enough to know what they want to change? Because they think,
They usually, after the diagnosis of the organization and after our conversation about them as a leader, through the 360 or through whatever it is that we explored, they're usually able to say, oh, yeah, I'm a little too command and control-like. I'm too controlling. Or I'm not firm enough. I'm too prone to change my mind all the time as the winds blow. And I really need to have a more solid, consistent communication. I don't have a strong enough sense of authority. or I wobble when people disagree with me, or I don't have enough gravitas, or I have too much gravitas and I'm unopen to other people, or I don't have a clear game plan. I tend to think so intuitively that people don't really know where I'm coming from, or I'm too much of a visionary and not enough feet on the ground, or my feet are too much on the ground and I don't have enough vision. I mean, I don't have enough trusting relationships. They're usually through the 360 or through my conversations and through the diagnosis of the organization, able to identify any of a number of things like that, like those that I just mentioned, that are clearly the area to work on, clearly the area that needs to transform over time. So we have a clear sense of where they want to go. We have a clear sense of what the problem is that they want to solve in terms of their own consciousness and their own leadership behavior. And then I march through my recipe in a sense. We try to understand the paradigm that is currently in them, or sets of paradigms that exist in them, how they formed. You know, the nature of most paradigms is they form inside each of us for a reason. We have worldviews or ways of seeing and being in the world that shaped for lots of different factors. Some of it is our innate motivation. Some of it is the childhood that we grew up in, and some of the conditions in that childhood that shaped how we are in the world. Some of us have been through trauma, and the avoidance of future trauma is what defines how we are in the world. So we have to understand the forces that shape the paradigm of the leader first before you can go about changing that paradigm. Even if you have a vision for a new paradigm, those forces that created the current paradigm are deep and not to be scoffed at, not to be treated lightly. Many leaders try to break out of their paradigm, but can't because those forces are so big. And so my job is to help them see those forces, recognize them, identify them, understand them. And through that understanding, we can start to find the kind of the fulcrum point that will cause a shift. And so that's the next phase. It's multiple sessions over time to figure that out and to help dislodge the old paradigm.
But at least it would seem to me that the CEO is open to your suggestions and your process by the very fact that they engaged you, brought you in to start this whole process itself, right? So that is very significant in and of itself, that they have opened the door and they recognize that there is something that they are going to ultimately have to do.
I think that is. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
And no, the fact they make an offer, they make the first step, which indicates that, you know, they're halfway there, right? It's those people that don't want to listen, that are the bigger problem, or that are somehow more interested in just running an organization. Doesn't really matter how well it's doing. All they're only concerned with that role or that power or whatever it happens to be. I mean, I've seen so many, many, many bad leaders. Yeah. They might not be CEOs, but they're senior managers or senior executives within an organization, and they're bad, but they have it. They somehow managed to navigate power and use power to get where they are and have huge responsibilities and can leverage it across the organization. And another, you know, we can go back to Trump. They're perfect example, right? But there are many others, and I'm sure people who are listening know people that they have worked for who they quickly consider or clearly consider to be bad leaders, but they're bosses, right? Yep, it happens over and over and over again.
I think that's right. I if somebody's already working with me and they're already looking in the mirror or wanting to look in the mirror and not so frightened about what they may see if they look in the mirror. And so there's a what we call in my world simply a felt need for change. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to shift a paradigm requires a strong felt need, because those forces that create the paradigm are pretty powerful. So you need an equal, if not greater, desire to shift that paradigm. So it's half the battle. It's not all the battle, but they come with some felt need. And part of my job is to fan the flames of that felt need so that they feel it's strong enough that that they're willing to overcome some of the other forces that keep them where they are currently. So yes, it is half the battle, and most, you know, maybe some percentage of leaders, maybe most, don't want to look in the mirror. And I frankly, that's why I say, okay, if you don't want to look in the mirror, I don't want to work with you, because there won't be enough felt need for change. Yeah.
So I start thinking about, or at least when you were talking about that, I was thinking about all those people that after New Year's sign up to go to the gym and start losing weight. You know, they'll go and they go for a few weeks and then, you know, they lose interest. But if they're going and they find that inspiring person to help them on that journey, to recognize where they are and who they are, and align a set of actions with their goals, that person, say like you being the coach, can lay out that plan on how to get to losing weight, whatever weight, or getting in shape for some event or something of that sort, or whether it's 6 month or a lifelong change. You're the inspiration, you know, because there are many, many people that start that and then they give up, or they don't really change how they act or what they eat or their exercise longer than a couple of weeks, and they fall off the wagon, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I yes and no. You know, I at some level, I suppose I am an inspiration. But if the more I'm an inspiration, the less it's coming from inside of them. And so I would say I may be a facilitator, but I want the inspiration to be in them. And this is a crucial difference between how I coach and how I see some other people coaching, not everybody. But if the, you know, you see a lot of these coaches and life coaches, personal trainer kind of folks, they're going to be cheerleading and they're going to be challenging and they're going to be doing stuff. And the person on the receiving end goes, oh, wow, I love my trainer. I love my coach. He or she is so inspirational. But then what they're doing is relating to the coach as a child might relate to a parent, in a dependency relationship with that coach who is the primary force for change. Now you take the coach out of the equation, what's the person left with? Very little of their own inner resource to change. So if I smell any of that idolatry going on of me, I already know I haven't done my job. My job early on is to keep the ownership of one's own change squarely in that person. Now, maybe that sounds inspirational, but it's not idolatrizing me at all. It is me being a force for, you know, a stand for them owning their own process, owning their own journey. And the more they own their own journey, and I become simply a guide on that journey, the more likely they're going to succeed, and the more sustainable their changes will be. So yeah, just I quibble a little bit with the inspirational word.
Got it. Yeah. So what about the people that are not the CEOs, but are they're managers? They could be senior managers of some sort, VPs, senior directors, executive VPs, something. How do you work with them that's different than a CEO, for example?
Well, in almost all cases, I'm working with the organization, as a whole. Uh-huh. In partnership with the CEO, we wrap our arms around the whole organization and look to lift that whole system to a higher level. So if I'm working with a, you know, VP of engineering or the head of marketing in organization, I'm working with them in the context of working with the whole system. And they're already part of a larger transformation or change effort. Because of that, there it's a lot easier to support this head of engineering or head of marketing in their own journey. It's part of a larger system, and the systemic change and the culture change of the larger system reinforces their own personal change as well. So it's not much different than working with the CEO. In fact, if they're a chief marketing officer or chief whatever, reporting to the CEO, then part of what I'm trying to help the CEO do is to help the whole team own the whole system and together shape the whole system. And so I'm simply coaching other people, coaching the team as a team and coaching the individuals on the team and coaching the CEO, and they're all working together to affect the system. So it's actually not much different. Where it becomes potentially different is when I'm working with a chief marketing officer and I'm working with them and them alone, or I'm working with them and their team, but they sit in the context of a larger system. And then often the problems in the marketing organization are a reflection of two things. They're a reflection of the consciousness of the leader of the marketing organization and his or her team, but they're also reflection of the culture in which they reside. And if the culture in which they reside is toxic or problematic, then the chief marketing officer not only is trying to affect change in their organization, but they're going to have to influence the larger organization, or they're going to bump up against the limitations of that larger organization. That's the much harder problem for them and for me. And so, you know, I'm trying to help them influence the CEO to partner with them. And then I'm, you know, I'm climbing up the food chain one more level so that I can
run
the whole system. If I'm not able to climb up the food chain, if I'm not able to influence the CEO, then it's just a harder road for the chief marketing officer whomever I'm working with. And often that person will leave. Often if there's too much of disparity between their consciousness or where they're going and the quality of the organization in which they reside and the quality of the consciousness of the CEO, if that disparity is too great, they will just eventually say, thank you for this coaching. I'm so grateful the company paid for it. Now I'm going to leave because I can't really get my CEO to change.
Well, isn't that in some ways having a bad boss, right? You're out of sync with your boss because they aren't doing the right thing for one reason or another. And that's making an assumption that you are, but you see your boss as being kind of antagonistic to your environment or how you feel you can succeed. And one way or another, you have to leave, I would think, right?
Yeah, it depends. I mean, I'd say there are two scenarios in which you would leave. One would be exactly what you just described, which is this is a toxic company and I can't change it. And I'm trying to change my own area, but I can't. That would be bad boss or toxic organization. Mm-hmm. The other scenario is simply my boss, my supervisor, the CEO, and I are paradigms apart.
Got it.
You know, I live in stage 5 consciousness or stage 4 consciousness. They live in stage 2. They're not bad. They're actually quite benevolent and kind. The organization is not toxic. It's pretty benign and pretty good, but it's not the shape of who I am and what I'm trying to create. And so we're just paradigms apart. And I know that, and I need to leave and find either run my own organization or find a leader that fits more the shape of who I am.
So we have talked about so much over the two previous parts and now about 45 minutes. What is it that we haven't touched on that you would like to make sure that we don't lose sight of as we kind of come to the end of this conversation? And I want to make sure that we capture everything that's important to you and that we communicate well to our listeners. So what am I missing here? Well,
I think we probably need to summarize and try to look at the whole thing systemically, which we started with that. But now if listeners have listened to all three parts, we're going to be able to connect the dots and look at the larger system in which we currently exist. And so that would be kind of, I think that would be fun and instructive. Let me see if there's any piece missing. Well, certainly I'd like to do a couple of shameless plugs. I did a shameless plug about my book. But no, in terms of our narrative, I think the overall arc of the story has been revealed. And maybe if we do the summary, we might find something that was missing. I do think that we could double click on any one of those areas and go even deeper. But let's try to summarize and capture the whole.
Can we do that now, or were you thinking of doing another?
Let's try to do it now. Maybe we can do it together. Yeah. But I'm going to try to start and give almost the brief version of what we've said, and then we can amplify a little bit. So basically, we started with the idea or the question of how do you help leaders improve this country or the world?
Correct.
And so we started with the belief that if we could help leaders become more effective and more healthy, we can create a better world. And so the primary aim is, you know, some of the way in which I think about it is, let's wrap our arms around the whole planet and let's see if we can shift the planet to another level. And so in order to understand that problem, we had to ask the question, what is the shape of our planet and what caused that shape? So we identified a number of different variables, if you will, that suggests that the planet is eroding. The problems with environmental pollution, problems with war and strife, problems with economic larger gap between the haves and the have-nots, continued racial tensions and other tensions between differing groups, et cetera, erosion of natural resources, on and on and on, toxins in the environment that are growing, which are creating more and more medical problems, where the medical industry, primarily the pharmaceutical industry, tries to apply allopathic strategies to try to help address symptoms, but never getting to the underlying causes. The underlying causes being the toxins, the way in which we will rape and pillage our environment, and the way in which we believe that we have a right to do that. We even talked about some of the Judeo-Christian ethic that may cause leaders to, or where leaders believe it's our God-given right to do what we're doing. And if we continue to believe it's our God-given right, we will destroy the planet.
Well, we certainly did touch on all of those things and how far we have come from that kind of philosophy of living with our planet instead of exploiting it or extracting from it as if it is something disassociated from our human reality, right? So much of what we have been doing is take it, cut it. It's mine to exploit in any way that I see fit. And much of that seemed to have been very short-sighted. No one was thinking about the longer-term impact of dumping something in the river. Oh, let's just go dump it in the river. It'll just wash away, you know?
Yeah.
But over a accumulating over time, you've suddenly turned that nice little river into a cesspool, and your dumps all over the place are poisoning the land and your kids, and your forests are disappearing, and you're burning everything without thinking about the smog that it's creating, or you know, all the smoke and all that kind of thing. So
yeah, exactly. So that's the condition or the symptom.
Yeah.
And the causes have to do with our consciousness.
Yeah.
It's not the Republicans causing it or the Democrats causing it, or it's not the Jews causing it or the Christians causing it, or it's that the modal level of consciousness on the planet would predict that this is how we would treat the planet. Mm-hmm. And the leaders of our planet or the leaders of our organizations are living in a modal level of consciousness that reap the benefits of this very same strategy. Very few billionaires walk around going, I'm the problem. What they say instead is, I'm the solution and just follow my lead. But the lead that they're creating has built up a massive amount of wealth for them and a massive amount of destruction for the planet. So the consciousness of leaders in positions of power are not going to be the solution. Find me one leader who's a billionaire who says, I'm giving it all away and I've wreaked havoc. And I now, it's very rare.
You're suggesting that Jeff Bezos isn't thinking that way?
Yeah, right. I'm suggesting Jeff Bezos is not thinking that way. That's right. So now I'm not saying they're bad people. I think many of them have a benevolent desire to do good. And some of the way in which they think about that is through philanthropy. Mm-hmm. But philanthropy, you know, is redistributing some of the money to some extent. But it's done within a consciousness.
Right.
And if the quality of the planet is created by the consciousness of the leaders, then they would have to shift their consciousness in order to create a different planet. And therein lies the big problem. And so go ahead.
Yeah, there's a guy, his name is Anand Giridharadas. Herodotus, yeah, I think that's it. Really brilliant guy who essentially is saying the same thing, you know, that suddenly these billionaires are turning around and wanting to save the world that they created. Mm-hmm. It's like asking the fox into the hen house. It's like, it's not going to happen.
Yes.
It's naive to think so, and that they have to get out of the way so that it can be really fixed.
Yes, I vaguely remember reading a book that he wrote in that spirit, and it's
yes, exactly. So
we're following the dictum, the simple dictum: you can't solve today's problems from the quality of consciousness that created them. And so the answer is going to be to shift the consciousness of the planet, and the way that needs to happen is you shift the consciousness of leaders, either the current leaders, not likely to happen, but you help build the consciousness of the future leaders of the planet and help them grow and develop, to help them see more systemically, more long-term, help them become more aware, self-aware. That will, by definition, shift the consciousness, wherein in a future different consciousness, we're more likely to make decisions that care for the well-being of the planet. That really is the storyline of our whole conversation. How you go about shifting the consciousness, that's we need to double click on that much more to understand it. But
well, that's a whole course, right? Or a whole life in some
whole
ways.
Life. Yeah. And it's a workshop. I've got a workshop called The Art of Transformational Coaching. If you go to my website, you can sign up for it to learn about how do you help others shift their mm-hmm. consciousness, shift their paradigms. I think that's the most interesting game in town as it relates to COVID.
Well, I urge all our listeners to go to your website and look at that, because I am thinking that the people that are listening to this podcast are the ones that are really the people that are going to make those changes or are open to make those changes or open to learning to make those changes.
I would hope so.
Yeah, I would certainly hope so.
Yeah. So that, you know, that's the story. I'm glad we did this way because it reminds me of something I want to say about shifting paradigms, but that's the story. And I feel some hope, you know, there are people in the world that are popping up and popping through. They're not the Faucis of the world and they're not the head of the CDC. Those folks are living in a consciousness that I think is partly creating the problem. It may or may not be the head of the World Health Organization. I don't think so. You know, there are people like Zach Bush, who is a wonderful medically trained doctor and researcher who is looking at the causes of the soil depletion, who's looking at, you know, Mother Earth as Gaia and recognizing the erosion and the fundamental causes that are eroding our planet and the effect of that erosion on our food system and the effect of that on our bodies. You know, he's a richly contoured systemic thinker. And there are people like him and others who's, you know, Marianne Williamson is certainly a powerful thinker. And
it's funny.
You know, we'll find tons of them.
Yeah.
But these they're popping up. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, like Marianne Williamson, people thought, oh, she's sort of like so spacey running for president. But the things that she was saying were on the money. You know, she really had a lot that was interesting and provocative to say during the earlier parts of the campaign and made you think, well, yeah, you know, she's kind of right about this stuff.
Yeah, and at least she's putting herself out there, and she had no chance of becoming president.
No,
knew that, but she had a platform.
She had a platform, and she wanted to, put the agenda on the table, right?
Yeah.
Get her cards on the table so that people started thinking about it in a much more proactive and positive way, which is nothing but good can come of that.
Yeah. So I think, you know, in terms of critical mass, little by little, there are more and more people wondering, how did this COVID get created? And
right.
How are we in this problem? And is it really that dangerous? And what's causing the danger? Zach Bush, for example, talks about how the virus seems to partner with other molecules in our bodies.
Right.
That are toxic. So if you're in a toxic environment and you have a lot of toxicity in your body, then the virus partners with that. And the combination then becomes the problem. And so people who have fewer toxins in their body and in an environment that has fewer toxins are less susceptible. So is the problem the virus or is the problem the toxins? And if we don't address the likelihood that the problem is the toxins, then we are missing the point. We're going to give people a shot, a vaccination to address the virus when in fact the virus is not a problem. The virus has been around for a long time, or similar viruses have been around a long time. Why is it now emerging? So there are people popping through that are asking these questions and answering them. And you know, I'm stepping forward, you're stepping forward, more and more people stepping forward and saying, I'm part of this critical mass that is challenging the prevailing paradigm. And the more we do this, the more the house of cards will come toppling down. And that's really the aim. Little by little, one step at a time, and some other leader's going to pop through tomorrow or the next day with a point of view that rattles the cages of the prevailing paradigm. And that's what I'm about, what I'm trying to do.
Right. Me too. So I think that, I want to kind of wrap this up. This is, we could talk There's so much here, and I want to urge listeners to go to your website, read your books, sign up for one of your sessions, participate or learn a lot more. Keith, this has been amazing. It's truly been amazing. I'm so glad that I reached out to you and made the connection. And I hope longer term that we stay connected and you know, that I can help you somehow with this and in other ways. And I know that I'm going to read your books and use it, because I know leadership is paramount to me about making that impactful change. A lot of people are doing great things, but if you don't know how to do it and don't know how to get people on board to really build effective teams, then it's a waste of time, right?
Yeah, I think so. Or it puts, I used to have the saying, great payday, no difference. You know, great working with these organizations, they're paying me to help them change, but it's not really shifting the paradigm of the organization and of the consciousness of the leadership. So I stopped getting big paydays trying to help change these behemoths. Instead, I charge less to the small to medium sized companies.
And that's great.
I want to help the future leaders of our planet.
Well, Keith, thank you so much. This has been fabulous.
My pleasure.
Greatly appreciate it.
You've been a delight to explore this with. All right.
Yeah, it's been great.
Thanks for listening today. Do you have an idea for a podcast? Let me know. Visit my website. You can contact me there or send me an email at chip@earthplus30.com. Until next time, this is Chip Spear.